28 minutes past seven on Wednesday night's Arena. January, not to mind January in lockdown, is a good time to take up a new hobby or an interest. Art appreciation is one of those interests that can be both exciting but a bit daunting. Now, what we're talking about here is the ability to look at a painting or a sculpture with knowledge and in so doing gain more satisfaction from the work. The National Gallery is starting an online course tomorrow, but we decided to ask our own two art experts, Jessica Fahey and Sarah Wilson, to pick a few paintings from the National Gallery collection and tell us how we might approach reading the intention of the artist and understanding the period in which they worked. I'll start with you, Jessica, because you're going to be part of this course, in fact, in the National Gallery starting tomorrow. What exactly is involved in reading a painting?
So there's quite a few different ways of doing it, which I think is what makes it so exciting. So some people would be interested more in formalist concerns or the materials, so exactly what it looks like, how it's made. And then other people are more interested in the social context of, you know, how it's created, who it was created for, or the context of the artist. So we have all of these different avenues to explore with any given artwork, which allows us to, you know, kind of focus in on certain areas or try and, you know, zoom out from it and see what we can learn about the time in which it was created. So we use the artwork as evidence sometimes as well.
And I guess the first thing, the simple thing we have to do is, what are we looking at? What exactly is it?
Exactly, that's the key. So you just stand in front of it and you think you may know what you're looking at, but when you have to start, you know, putting it into words and describing it, you all of a sudden start to realize more details. You start to notice specific things about the choices that the artist made that might be significant. And over enough, you know, time of looking at other paintings, you kind of train your eye to it. And of course, you can also read and, you know, study it in order to put together kind of almost like an argument for the painting or for the evidence that you're finding within the painting.
And also there are other more formal things like composition that we might look at in the history of the patron. Did anybody, you know, ask for this painting to be made? But we maybe talk about those couple of things in the specifics of the paintings that yourself and Sarah are going to speak about with us now. Sarah, in fact, you picked three paintings from the National Gallery collection. One of its monumental paintings, The Marriage of Strongbow and Eva by Daniel MacLeish, Grief by Jack B. Yeats. But we're going to start with the European Fra Angelico. And just, if you are, if you're on Twitter and you can get yourself near a phone while you're listening to us now or some kind of device, we'll actually tweet up the images that we're talking about so you can follow the sort of the guidelines that Sarah and Jessica are giving us. But we're starting, as I said then, Sarah, with Fra Angelico, Saints Cosmas and Damien and their brothers surviving at the stake. doesn't sound like a nice place to be. I suppose starting with the idea that Jessica just gave us there, the first step is, well, what are we looking at? Give us the description of what it is.
Absolutely. You want to describe what you see. So this is a very small little piece. It's only about 37 by 46 centimetres, just a little bit over those dimensions. And we're looking at a number of figures gathered in an outdoor piazza. And in the foreground, there's a group of people with halos. We'll notice as well that the halos are stuck to the back of their heads like a CD, and they're tied together in a circle. Two of these men are almost identical, and they're surrounded by flames. But what makes this really interesting is that the flames of the fire actually tend to bend away from the halo wearers, and it's sort of threatening the other figures who are standing around the fire. And all of this is being watched by a row of very well-dressed people up on a balcony in the upper section of the painting. So between the halos, the twin brothers, this sort of failed martyrdom by fire, all of this together lets us know that we're looking at a Christian narrative scene of the failed martyrdom of Cosmas and Damien. And Cosmas and Damien were 3rd century AD Christian physicians living in Asia Minor, which is modern day Turkey, during the Diocletian persecutions. And what happened was they refused to sacrifice to the pagan gods of the Roman Empire. So the Roman consul, who is our very importantly dressed central figure on the balcony, orders their execution. Because we have to remember that the Roman Empire was an enormously vast province, about that vast empire. And it was very important that there was a central focus, that everyone was worshipping at the same time, was worshipping the same object. So for someone to say that they weren't going to worship the pagan gods was a big problem. So naturally, this results in the execution of a number of Christians. Right. So God, they attempt to burn them alive. God intervenes, turns the flames away from the Christians and towards their persecutors. Of course, though, as tends to happen in a lot of these martyrdom stories, after the more creative way of death fails, the persecutors come back and say, well, we'll just chop your heads off.
Yeah. Right, fair enough. So I suppose, Sarah, touching on telling us exactly what's involved in describing what's in front of our eyes, Jessica, but we need to start looking a little bit further than that. And this is where the reading of the painting comes into play, really, and maybe our history of the period and the type of techniques that that Fra Angelico is using here in the painting.
Absolutely. So as Sarah mentioned, it's a very small scale painting and it's very beautifully painted in these very bright colours. One of the things that we kind of know about, you know, particularly 15th century Florentine art is that quite a few of the painters would have trained as illuminators, so manuscript illuminators. This is true of Fra Angelico. So he would have learned those skills of painting on a very, very minute scale. And you can kind of just at a glance of your eye see the similarity between the type of colour and the type of brushwork used between, you know, this work and manuscript. The other thing is that there's very clear mathematical single point perspective in this work. So it looks like a very believable three-dimensional box that these figures live and exist within. So it's very clear and very believable, which for looking at the history of art, that's a new thing in the 15th century. So it's, you know, really kind of, you know, a sort of show-off piece, if you like, for this time period. And then the other thing, of course, that we all want, and this is what makes the painting so special, is some information about the patron. And because the two men that look very similar here, who are Cosmas and Damien, are Medici saints, and we know that this is a small narrative piece and that it seems to be missing the rest of the scenes from around it. We, in fact, know it was for an altarpiece in San Marco in Florence, which was patronized by Cosimo de' Medici. And these are his name saints because of the surname Medic and the fact that Cosmas and Damien are physicians. So we have all these links and ties. So we can actually then match this to one of the most famous altarpieces painted in the 15th century in Florence and one of the most famous patrons. So just that little bit of recognition of knowing the use of name saints and whose name saints were who in Florence in the 15th century means we can tie all these other points of history together.
Yeah. Let me just reiterate for people who are listening who want to look at the image that we're speaking about. We have it up on our Twitter page right now, which is at RTE Arena. So you can actually look at the painting as Sarah and Jessica speak to us about it. You touched on, Sarah, just a second ago, you started talking about the figure who's up on the balcony in the middle. Composition is vitally important to this. You know, we have the fella in the red gear up on the balcony. We also have the group on the stake or at the stake in the centre in the foreground. The composition around that is very interesting as well.
It is. As Jess was saying, it's very beautifully done. This is all about symmetry and balance and using these sort of pure geometrical shapes, because Renaissance art at this period is all about creating a sense of harmony and balance and not just reflecting nature, but actually improving upon it and making it better. And if you have something that's harmonious, mathematical perspective, all these qualities were believed to represent beauty and truth and create this wonderful sense of symmetry within the work.
All right. So that's the first painting and giving us a sense of the sort of things that we might look for there. So we're now going to tweet a second painting up on our Twitter page at RTE Arena. And this is Daniel MacLeish, Irish artist, 1806 to 1870, The Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife. And this is a painting from 1854. Again, well, let's go to you on this one, Jessica, to describe what we're looking at. There are a lot of folks in this particular painting. Big wedding.
Absolutely, and quite a raucous one as well, in that it's on a battlefield. So this is very much of its era of a Victorian dramatic scene, whereby they loved a sort of romantic story, but all the more better if you could turn it into something, you know, kind of over the top theatrical. So the organization of this composition is actually incredibly complex. It's also an incredibly large painting, 3 by 5 meters. Most people have been into the National Gallery will know it well, because it's just impossible to miss it, really. So within the scene that we're looking at, in the foreground, quite lit up, sort of well lit, we have fallen figures, and we have a man with a harp, and we have a woman with her hands in the air wailing. On the right-hand side of the figure, we have kneeling warriors, or on the picture plane, we have kneeling warriors. And then in the centre, where our eye is sort of drawn in, because there's a little bit of space that leads our eye in, we see a very pretty woman wearing gold, and she is holding the hand of a man in armour, and between them is a bishop with his hand raised in prayer, sort of in blessing. And then in the background, we still have the battle raging on with a few sort of burning towers and all this extraordinary activity. So quite a complex piece, but it's something that is, you know, really fun to examine, because there is so much going on, and actually it really gives a lot to those who look for the details.
Yeah, and if we start looking at those details, then we're looking, I suppose, the great idea is, sure, all the Irish folk will all have red hair, stuff like that. Do we look? Can we spot Irishness, or particular, you know, signifiers or iconography that might suggest Irishness in this painting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We do have some record that, in fact, both Strongbow and Aoife may have had red hair, but it is a very typical thing to depict the Irish this way. But there's actually very specific antiquarian details in this painting, because Daniel MacLeish was friends with people like Thomas Croker and George Petrie and all of these other antiquarians in the 19th century. And they were really interested in finding objects that related to the, you know, the cultural history of Ireland, particularly sort of pre-colonial one. And they went looking for objects. Sometimes they misidentified them. So one of the things we have in this painting is what's known as the Brian Boru harp, which would have been believed to have been Brian Boru's, but it's actually since been dated as a 15th century harp. It's in the long room in Trinity. It has broken strings, which is quite symbolic. But some of the other objects that we have are things like gold torques, the crozier, in fact, that's been held here. And they're all, you know, copied from actual artifacts that were found at the time that were Irish artifacts. So he's trying his best, but he does make some mistakes, because there are Viking tattoos and Viking symbols, and there's also African shields. So he wasn't quite there yet, but he's certainly trying to get the details correct.
And as I say, if you want to see the image, go to our Twitter page at RTE Arena, and you'll see Daniel MacLeish's The Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife up on that page. And I suppose, Sarah, those sort of things that Jessica's talking about, looking for the anomalies in the paintings, there's a little bit of fun in that for the art historian. And I suppose, if you were ever looking for a forgery, those are the type of things that might give it away. Little misplaced items or wrong ideas, you know, somebody putting a 20th century item in the midst of a 19th century painting.
Yes, well, I think they love this idea of adding in anything that might add to the sense of realism or the sense of romanticism. Mm. And of course, they don't always get it right. It's not necessarily designed to be historically accurate. You know, most weddings don't take place on a battlefield straight after the fall of Waterford. But it's to add to this sense of melodrama. Mm. And that's something that the Victorians really loved.
Right.
Daniel MacLeish belongs to a group of artists that we refer to as the Romantics, for that very reason. It's all about drama, it's all about emotion, it's all about adding this sense of realism as much as they can to the work.
Yeah, all right. Let us move on then to choice number three, and we'll tweet this image up on it at RTE Arena right now as well. This is Jack B. Yeats. Grief is the title of the painting. Are we really talking about Ireland's greatest painter, Sarah, when it comes to Jack B. Yeats?
Oh, I think he's a very strong contender, and particularly Grief. I would argue it's one of his best works, and certainly one of the major draws in the National Gallery.
So give us the description then of what we're looking at here.
This is very different from the other two that we've spoken about. This is one that requires a little bit more from the viewer, because it's painted in an abstracted manner. Now, it's not abstract. It is still based on subject matter. But it's the sort of work that helps if you just relax your eyes a little bit to try and figure out what we're looking at. Children are extremely good at spotting the details of this. So in the center, we have a fierce rider on a white horse, and he's raising his arm up. And in front of him, you have these blue figures that are streaming forward. And on the left-hand side, you'll be able to notice that some of them are actually holding rifles or bayonets, so they're soldiers. Then in the background, you can just about make out the gable end of a house with a protruding flag. Now, that house looks okay, but the houses to the left of it have not survived as well and are collapsed in rubble. And then there's red flames or streaks of orange suggesting fire. And beside them, a big black hole where perhaps a bomb has gone off, causing this destruction. In the distance, you've got the vague suggestion of green fields. And then in the foreground, you have two figures, a white-haired bearded man who's kneeling in profile, and he's raising his hands up to his face to catch a few drops of red paint, blood. And then to the right of him is a kneeling woman who is holding the body of a wounded or dead child. Now, I don't think this is supposed to depict any particular war scene. Yeah. I don't think it's meant to be World War II or 1916 or anything like that, but it's just simply an expression of the horrors of war.
The other thing that's really noticeable when you look at this painting, I mean, Jack B. Yeats, you think of the yellow, you think of particularly the blue, that dark blue, and the white, the wash of the white that's in behind, and that the mixture's in with the blues. The colours are, I suppose, tell us an awful lot about what Yeats is trying to do.
Absolutely. I think for artists, particularly those working in the 20th century, pure colour was extremely important. Many of them actually believed that it had transcendent properties, that it had the power to remove barriers of language, religion, iconography, social structures, because viewers would have a very instinctual and universal reaction to it. You don't have to know about Irish history. You don't have to know about Christian biblical stories in order to have a reaction to colour. Mm. So, for example, blue is, you know, many of us would associate that with grief, the title, depression, sadness. Red, the other dominant colour in the painting, reflects violence, blood, anger, and so on. But what I would stress is that there's a lot of room for the viewer in this painting. So what I see and how I react to it might be very different to what you see and how you react to it. And neither of us is right or wrong. It's very much an individual experience.
Just one final point on yes, because we are in the 20th century with this painting. No patrons involved here, just the artist wanted to paint it.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that makes it really quite fascinating. This is just simply Yeats's desire to explore and convey emotion. And that makes it very unique compared to, say, the other two examples that we looked at. It's purely for his own satisfaction.
All right. Well, listen, fascinating to just go through three paintings in that way. I presume, Jessica, this is exactly the type of thing you'll be doing at the online course.
Absolutely, yeah. So we start tomorrow and it's an 8-week course where we essentially trace the kind of rebellion in art from the time of the Impressionists up until the Abstract Expressionists would be people like Jackson Pollock. So we're going to go through different movements, but also talk quite extensively about abstract art because this course is in conjunction with the Mondrian exhibition. And within that, we talk about things like Sarah was just mentioning of this sort of idea of the spiritual quality of pure colour and how if we take away the subject matter, art becomes more universal and we get this kind of spiritual connection between colour and shape and movement within a painting. So it's one of the things I love teaching because it does have this feeling that you start out almost like the lawyer sort of representing abstract art against those who say my 3-year-old could do it. Yeah. But it's actually really fascinating, the story behind how this happens. And it kind of really starts with, you know, the experimentation of the realists and then the impressionists.
Right.
And I don't think people necessarily know that story. But yeah, we start tomorrow at 2 p.m.
All right. Well, listen, sounds very interesting indeed. But thanks for your 20-minute course that the both of you have just given to us. That's Sarah Wilson and Jessica Fahey there. And the online course that we mentioned, Art Appreciation at the National Gallery, is called Art Appreciation Breaking the Mold. Jessica is one of the teachers on that course. The course is tied to the work of Mondrian, which we covered on the programme here back on December the 17th, when we could do a walk around in the National Gallery. We were there with Director Sean Rainbird. So you can still access tickets for that exhibition, nationalgallery.ie.